What I realized is that the process of learning Sami language not only did help me to gain a better understanding of the Sami interpretation and relationship to the Arctic landscape, but more specifically, it actually changed my perception of time. My next kind of thought was, could this community help me understand the very basic thing of what is our human role in the cycles of life and death?
Join explorers and travelers on their journeys and discover distant places and fascinating cultures. From the highest peaks and densest jungles into the heart of adventure, this is Unfolding Maps with Eric Lawrence.
Sitting in a snow-covered tent, surrounded by a pretty harsh environment where no horizon can be seen in the Arctic Circle, cooking with reindeer blood and learning the fascinating Sami language. Photographer Erika Larsen experienced all of this when she lived with the Sami people in Scandinavia for a total of 4 years. She had been looking for people who lived in unity with nature and were able to interpret their landscapes for the rest of the world. Erika was able to gain unprecedented access into the lives, work, and culture of the Sami community. Her work has been shown all over the world. For instance, in the National Geographic magazine, in the Smithsonian National Portrait Gallery in Washington, and the United States Embassy in Oslo. What did she learn about the Sami culture? And what does the oldest tradition in the world, storytelling, mean to her? That's what I want to talk about in this episode. Please enjoy. Hi, Erika. Welcome to Unfolding Maps. I'm really, really pleased to have you here. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Powerful stories help us understand each other and our world. This is a subtitle of an interview with you at the National Geographic Society Storyteller Summit quite a few years ago about one of the oldest professions in the world, which is storytelling. And I would like to start our conversation by diving into this profession a little bit and by sketching out parts, at least, of your personal path to the art of storytelling. You became, as far as I know, a storyteller through photography primarily. So maybe let's just start in the beginning. How was your interest in photography initially awakened?
So, yes, I grew up with photographs, as everybody, I think, probably in my age group did. And there was kind of two or three different levels. But the first one that sort of sparked my, I would say, realizing that the photograph was more than just recording memories. It was a way to transport you to other worlds. And it was a way to actually transform the way that we communicate, the way that you can actually communicate. So my father had been working on the Hubble space telescope with NASA at the time. And so in the early years, he was bringing home some of the first photographs that were coming back. And I specifically remember when he was bringing back the pictures from like Jupiter and Saturn. And he'd bring them home and they were printed on Kodak paper. I remember like looking on the back and it was Kodak. But on the front, I was holding, and specifically Saturn. I remember that, like holding this picture of Saturn with its rings. And I thought to myself, oh my goodness, in that moment, and I actually don't remember how old I am, because that's the tricky thing, how old I am now, I do remember that. But I don't remember how old I was then, because I think that's what's also sort of beautiful about time and memories, is that they, you know, they no longer become linear and they start to blend. But so I actually don't know how old I was. Maybe I was 11, I'm not sure. But I remember holding it, holding Saturn, and thinking to myself, how is this possible? How is it possible that this planet that's so far away and that I'm so mesmerized by and that seems like kind of my wildest dream is actually a part of me? Because when I was holding it, I actually felt like I was a part of the planet. And so my brain just linked that with photography, that it must be photography is this bridge or this portal or this tool to be able to merge my physical self with all the things that we think of as outer and at the same time remind us that they're all within us as well.
So it's really a kind of bridge through a space and time in this case.
Yeah. And that's what, yeah. And then, you know, like now thinking about photography, I mean, that's exactly what it is. I actually think it is like the greatest tool to break our understanding of time and remind us that we are time. And so therefore it can take on many different ways and aspects and possibilities. And the camera can be like a time machine.
Yeah, time, I think, is quite an essential part of your work, right? Probably not explicitly with every photo you take. Probably you don't think about it all the time. But to use photography to explore our understanding of time, I think, is something that has stuck with you all the way from back then to today, right?
Yeah, no, I would say one of the main... I would say I actually do think about it all the time. You know, it's always in my consciousness. I actually think I use photography very, very like specifically to travel through time and to, again, like constantly break my own like kind of preconceived ideas about what time is, because I think I'm constantly going, even though at one time I might feel like things are sort of clear, then all of a sudden it gets cloudy again and I have to break my own ideas and my own understanding. And so the camera, I constantly use it as a way to remind me that time is more than what I'm seeing in the moment. So yeah, I think I'm actually, I don't think it goes unnoticed. I think it's actually probably one of the prime motivators of my work. And, you know, then that obviously ties into storytelling and my belief in what storytelling actually is and what I'm doing with it.
Can you put that into words? Like, if you do think about time quite a bit and consciously while working, how does that influence your photography and your sense of what a storytelling is or should be?
Yeah, so I think, first and foremost, I think storytelling for me, and again, most of the things I'm going to probably talk about, I'm not the biggest on generalizations. This is my interpretation of how I use these tools and how they sort of play out in my life. But I think of storytelling, yeah, as one of the kind of the oldest professions around. And I think that we are, you know, by storytelling, we have the ability to express who we are in relationship to the world around us, and then more specifically to where we are in time. And then from that, you know, right, as people, as a storyteller and you must also be, I think, an absolutely extraordinary listener. Like, that is the main thing. You can't be a storyteller without being a listener. And so when you realize that, or when I realized that really being a listener was my job, then I realized that we're able to sit in this moment that we perhaps are saying this is the time we're in, and then all these other kind of aspects of time open up. And it could be, you could look at it really straightforward, like somebody's going to talk to you about their own past. So, I know, okay, maybe that's basic, someone's talking about the past, but right? Imagine if in that silence of listening and somebody's talking about the past, what if all of a sudden this tool of the camera and this action of take embodying what it means to be a storyteller can kind of break down the walls, and you can experience the past and the future, right? As we talk about, you know, our hopes and our dreams, or as some people say, for them, the future is the past. So as they begin to explain the past, we have this kind of way that we can sort of merge into what we think is about to come. And I think that that's exactly what storytelling is this ability to break down all the walls and bring us into the past, present, and future, break down that linear aspect and allow us to live in the essence of this communication. And I think the more silent you become, that you don't only hear it, but you feel it and you can smell it and you can perceive it with so many senses. And that's what storytelling always was, right? If you look back 10,000 years ago, you know, what was that point of storytelling? It was to bring community together. It was to merge with the sort of outside of what's going on, to bring you on a better hunt, to connect you more fine-tunedly to the animals and the changes in nature and all these things that we are, but somehow we tend to build up walls, but storytelling begins to break all of that. And then it reminds us that we are all of these things, and it opens up our senses again. So it has the ability to heal. It has the ability to teach us. And ultimately, I think the most important thing is it has the ability to sort of transform us to the sense that it can open up our consciousness.
And all of that, of course, if we are talking about the power of storytelling and the power of time, all of that also takes time, obviously. And what becomes pretty apparent when reading a little bit about your work is that you take quite a bit of time for your projects, at least for some of them. I believe one of your early projects spanned a time frame of 8 years, if I'm not mistaken, if my memory doesn't betray me. And the project that we want to talk about specifically today with regard to the Sami took you 4 years. Like, you have been spending time throughout 4 years living with the Sami in that case, right? Why do you in generally choose these really long time frames to spend working on your projects?
So let's see. What's really interesting is, had you asked me about that during the time, I would say, well, that seems really long. But now when you say it, I think when I hear 4 years and 8 years, it's like nothing. I mean, really think about it, especially the older you get. Think about when you hear the word 4 years, it goes by in like a blink. I mean, so quickly. I mean, 4 years seems like nothing. So actually, I don't even think it seems very long. But anyways, but if you had asked me during the 4 years, perhaps I would say that, yes, this is quite a long-term project. So why? I'm not specifically doing anything because it's long. I think what I'm doing is allowing the story to kind of predicate and tell me how much time I need to spend listening to it. So I think it's really that. It's not that I'm putting, you know, actually I start something and the story might be 5 minutes, and literally, and I'm not even being sort of, you know, kind of facetious about that. A story might only take 5 minutes, and that is as long as it should be, but perhaps things take longer. And so I would say that that length of time has to do with perhaps how long it takes me to understand and learn what it is I need to learn, or how long I perceive that to be. And so it's really, yeah, dictated on the story.
Okay, and with regards to the story you wanted to tell about the Sami, what was it in this case that you wanted to understand and to learn through this project? What intrigued you about them?
So the Sami worked, I'll give a little bit of background.
Yeah, sure.
So the 8-year project you were referring to, I had been photographing hunting in the US and Canada for about 8 years, and first working with just the, like, more adults in the culture of hunting. And then it bridged into, like, youth and hunting. So, you know, whatever, 18 and under, if you want to put a sort of age limit on it, and hunting, and sort of why youth in quite, you know, if you want to say sort of modern day societies that can go to the store and get food and don't really necessarily need a subsistence hunt to eat, why do they choose to hunt? And that was really, really important. And I worked on that part of it for about a year and a half. And the thing that I saw over and over was that there was something more instinctual going on. And it was about this remembering that we are a working part of nature, and that we're not separate from nature, and that we are nature. And some people choose to tap into that working part by this relationship to hunting. And so from that, I really wanted to understand that at a deeper level. So I wanted to have the opportunity to live with what would have been maybe a more traditional hunter-gatherer nomadic society that was still had very close roots with that today, and was also kind of functioning in modern economic society based on those ancestral traditions. And I first went to Peru to work in a rainforest setting. And I realized that the sort of independence that I needed, I wasn't able to have for the amount of time that I knew the story would take.
Independence from what? In this
meaning
case?
Being able to live by myself in a community and not need a translator, not need somebody to kind of guide me or be there. And it just didn't seem that that was going to happen in the rainforest setting. I think I would have had to kind of go and come and things like that. Ultimately, if we get into it further, I look at all the things we're doing as one long story with many chapters. And ultimately I met my husband in Peru, and now my life consistently goes back to Peru, and that part of the story is actually continuing. So it's really funny. It's just like the chapter opened, but we talk about time, then you kind of fast forward to 8 years later, that story begins again. But because at the time that it was just planting a seed there, and I wasn't really able to play out the kind of role that I needed to take on to listen to the story there, I thought to myself, and kind of quite naively, what's the exact opposite of the rainforest? And I thought to myself, oh, the Arctic. And for whatever reasons, I also tend to work quite intuitively, which I think also leaves me with a lot of openness to listening when I don't seem to have all the information already inside of me. And so I thought about the Arctic came to my mind. And I'm actually, my father's from Norway, so it wasn't completely out of my idea anyways. And I went to Norway, and I did a little bit of research, and I began thinking about Sami culture. You know, with a small understanding, I realized, you know, they were in kind of traditionally in the northern Scandinavian and northern Russia region there, and looked that, you know, with reindeer herding, which is only 10% of Sami people, the business or the kind of traditional work aspect part of it with reindeer herding is only 10% of Sami. But I looked at that, and, you know, all of a sudden you have this going from reindeer hunting to reindeer herding, which has, you know, huge ancestral importance for the culture. But 10% of the population is doing this in a very modern day setting as part of, you know, kind of this huge economic system that is the EU, you know, and regulated by the EU. So that was really interesting. And I thought, what does that look like? And what could I learn from them? So I thought in my head, that was the main catalyst to getting there. And then I thought about, how could I do this? How could I, you know, and so I reached out to three Sami women, because I had some other small interests that then went. I was interested in women's work within this setting. So then as I started to understand, you know, what region I was going to be concentrating in, I was very interested in the Arctic itself. And I thought, okay, so who are people that, especially, because this is probably about 2006 that I started the research, you know, the Arctic is getting quite important. And I thought, well, who are the people that we should be maybe consulting and understanding as we're looking at the Arctic as a more important part of this large world ecosystem? And I thought, wow, the Sami, you know, I think maybe understanding how they would interpret their landscape is really important. And my next kind of thought was, could this community help me understand the very basic thing of what is our human role in the cycles of life and death? And I know it seems very basic, and maybe if you look in the mirror, you can answer that for yourself. But I actually found that it wasn't so basic. I really was looking for people to help me understand that role that we take in these cycles. And so I wanted to understand that through the interpretation of Sami perspective. And my final kind of thesis, kind of the question for myself was, could I find so much silence that I could begin to hear again with new ears and with a new sense of being and with new eyes? So with all of those things in my backpack, I reached out to three Sami women, one in Norway, one in Sweden, one in Finland. And I told them my interest, and they all got back to me. And then one said to me, you can come without a translator. She said, I speak enough English, and I'd feel comfortable if you came without a translator. And that was really important to me, to not have to have one more level of translation. And I went, and I went for 2 weeks, and I stayed with her. And that began the four-year journey.
So how were these 2 weeks for you? Which kind of insights were you able to gain at this pretty much very first point of contact? And this time you spent over there, probably you had a lot to learn, a lot to absorb, and also I could guess quite a few insecurities on how to perceive, how to judge, or to try actively not to judge, how to be silent. I mean, that's a reoccurring theme that you already mentioned a couple of times, the strength and importance of silence in order to be able to do good storytelling.
Yeah, so the first 2 weeks were, I think I, you know, you go as, I would say, I mean, if you want to put it into sort of our life cycle perspective, you go like a child, meaning that I had enough information. Like you have enough information that you're not completely showing up like, well, I don't know anything what I'm doing, mm-hmm. but really not any information. So that everything that was being given to me, and I specifically mean that it is given to you, right? Like these things are given. They're not, you can't kind of go up there and expect this and take that. And, you know, it's the things that are sort of given to you. They're really given, you know, when they're given, you're kind of taking them really openly. So I would actually say the real importance of the 2 weeks is that she took the seed that was me or this idea and she planted it in the ground, and she kind of, I think, almost put like a structure to it and said, this is how, oh, not this is how, but she guided how she would want to tell me the story. And oddly, like that played out over 4 years, right? And I'm really, really, that means something to me. I actually think that sort of first contact, that first time when you meet someone, you know, you're really, without words, setting the tone for how you're going to navigate what's about to be, right? Mm-hmm. And that's what she did. And so some more, to put that more specifically, to give you like more solid examples, she said something to me, you know what? We don't need anybody telling a story about the Sami people. She's like, we've been storytellers since time immemorial. So that was the first thing she said. And then she said, but if you're interested in learning who we are as Sami people, you can't just come for 2 weeks. She goes, in order to understand us, you need to spend 1 year with us, because we as Sami people actually live our life based on a yearly cycle. Mm-hmm. And so to really see and understand who we are, you need to experience one entire year with us. And then the third thing she made clear was that Sami people really didn't need someone standing around. They said, you know, this is a really, it's a culture where everybody has an active part in what's going on. So it'd be really great to make yourself useful.
if to you put it politely.
To be here. And so she kind of really, I mean, I'm like paraphrasing, and she didn't like sit me down the first day and say those three things, but I would say yes. Over the 2 weeks, mm-hmm. those three things became quite apparent, that if I was to be able to embark on this journey as a storyteller and as a listener with her, these would sort of be the parameters.
And how did you feel about these parameters back then? Were you directly like, all right, I'm in? Or did you have to think about it a little bit? Because, for example, her telling you that you will need to stay at least a full year, I mean, that is quite a bit of time.
Well, yeah, actually, I actually specifically remember that. And I said, I didn't even think about it. I was like, oh, my last story, I worked on 8 years, so that's really fast. So I thought, you know, I actually didn't see a year as yes. any, I didn't see that as a, I actually saw it more as, well, if you're actually offering that, like, yeah. what a gift. Like, yes. what a gift to offer somebody that much time without it seeming weird or strange, right? You can't, like, show up in someone's room and be like, can I spend a year? I mean, it's a weird, it is, you know, I think when I take out all my kind of more, kind of whatever crazy thinking that I sometimes have, I mean, it is in normal everyday, that's sort of a weird thing to ask somebody, can I just spend years with you? So to the fact that she was offering it, and not only offering it, but sort of saying that that's the way it needs to be, I thought that was I mean, really, what a gift.
Yeah, definitely a great gift. To make it a little bit clearer in my imagination, could you describe a little bit who she was and how she lived, and thus also how then you lived with her?
Okay, so when I met her, she was in her, so the Sami people as groups, especially Sami reindeer herders, and maybe we can just kind of put this out there for the rest of the talk. But when I'm talking about Sami people, I'm referring to the 10% that are Sami reindeer herders. And it's really important to make that distinction, because to talk generally about Sami people isn't correct at all. So when I say Sami from now on, I'm talking about Sami reindeer herders.
And if we talk about numbers, I think somewhere in the material related to you, I found that at least, I mean, it's not the most up-to-date number, but just to have an idea, in 2014, there were all in all about 80 to 100,000 Sami in Scandinavia, and about 10% of them still really practiced the reindeer herding, right?
It's about right, maybe a little bit more, but yeah, more or less. Okay. Like you could say okay. A bit more, yeah. So like yeah. Somewhere in like 2000 range. I mean, and that some of that might go into Russia, but yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the Sami reindeer herders have a winter grounds and summer grounds, and that's really based on the reindeer, right? Where they graze and at what time. So when I went to visit Lila, I went to her summer. It was the summertime, so I went to her summer grazing grounds, and that's where her father's reindeer would have traditionally grazed. And so therefore they had their summer homes there since she was a child, and I'm sure since he was a child, and so on and so forth. So I showed up there, and she had a small lavo, which is a Sami tent. It's kind of lower to the ground than maybe you would say, like if you could think about the teepees that you would see in different cultures in the United States. So it's lower to the ground. And she had it set up outside of a cabin that her family had built. And that's where I stayed. And she set me up in there. And she said that was important because that would give me she would always say, I find when people from the outside come up here, they always really exhausted because they're sort of shedding parts of themselves. So she actually kind of brought that to my attention. And she said, I find the lavo is, you know, you're going to sleep on the ground and get yourself sort of more grounded in that regard to this area. So I was staying in this tent. And then, and Lila at the time, I don't know what her age was. She was definitely over 60. She's beautiful. She had really, really, really pale white skin. She was quite fair, hair. And she spoke to me in English, but she often spoke in Sami. And so she would actually have two Sami dialects, a Yule Sami dialect and a North Sami dialect. And at the time, I wouldn't know which one she was speaking, but it didn't matter because it was the sound of both dialects that actually, and so often she would speak to me in English, of course, but then sometimes she would just talk in Sami. And what I found really interesting, because this would also set the scene for the next few years, is just by hearing the sort of intonations and like the sound of what was going on in the language, it would bring you into a certain rhythmic kind of state of mind to just absorb things that were going on around, as opposed to trying to sort of analytically understand through language. And so she did that often. And I thought, wow, I remember just the language at the time, the way she spoke was like hypnotic. And it reminded me of photographing because it put me into the same state of mind as when I use a large format field camera for 90% of the Sami work specifically. And so it's the same sort of thing that large format camera does. It puts you into the sort of hypnotic state to therefore take in, more absorb what's going on, right? As opposed to directing it or, you know, sort of consciously trying to be involved in it. And so the way that she spoke related very much to the way that I was tapping into the visuals. And that set the scene there as well, that this wasn't going to be, of course I would change and grow tremendously through the story, but her process of storytelling, which is what she was doing, she was reminding me that it's exactly what I was as well. So I could see this sort of, not that, you know, I was Sami or anything like this, but that she was a storyteller. She was a cultural bearer for her life and world. And she was meeting me as I was a storyteller. So she kind of, in through those 2 weeks, she interpreted very quickly for me that I, or explained to me, showed me very quickly that we were both storytellers about to embark on a journey. And that was really, really important. And the last thing I can say that I remember, where we went mushroom picking. And she took me out and she would quickly, you know, kind of identify certain mushrooms. And so she had me hold, I can't remember if it was a little basket or something. And so she would point it out and I would begin to collect the mushrooms. And I would carry it and go back and, you know, as she would sort of, so it showed me that she was going to be guiding me, but I would be doing all the labor, all the work, all, you know, and that was her way of telling me that this is how you're going to learn. Mm-hmm. You're going to learn by doing. I'm not going to explain it to you. I'm not going to give it to you, but I'm going to kind of guide you, and you'll learn by doing. And again, that would play out over 4 years. And yeah, so I think that's...
These are already so many different fascinating aspects that it's hard to decide where to follow up with first, but let's give it a try. No, it's really, really interesting to hear that. Also, just the way she introduced you to her world in a way that... To use a cliche phrase, sounds very wise, but also was really indicative of what your 4 years would actually be like, right? For example, in terms of the language that you just mentioned, I know, or I believe to know, that language was in any way a very important factor for you, right, when you went there. Like, for example, I read somewhere that one of your initial questions was, as far as I know, to what extent language and landscape, for example, are related, and how the landscape and the outer world shape a culture, and in that regard, language. Have you found answers in that regard while living with a Sami?
Yeah, so yeah, the language was really, really important to me. And probably for the base reason, if you're starting to talk about storytelling, we're talking about communicating, right? Yes. And so language takes on many forms, but the actual, if you want to say practical idea of our verbal language, I was very, very interested in the Sami and in their ability to interpret the Arctic landscape. Mm-hmm. Obviously through the work that they do and through the sort of land stewardship and cultural ties, but specifically through their language, right? Do they, you know, I think I had read that, you know, this was an Arctic language that had more words to describe the natural world than most other languages around. And I thought that was really fascinating. Throughout the 4 years, it became really important, like first, like I said, to kind of absorb the language through the sound of it, which put me into a certain state of mind. And then to go through the process of, after, you know, a kind of a year and a half went on, I found Lila introduced me to a family to live with, that I could work as a housekeeper. Mm-hmm. And that was important for me because the first year I went back and forth between New York, where I was living at the time, and there. And just for, you know, practical reasons, one, like I said, you can't show up in 2 weeks and be like, I'm going to stay here for 4 years. And then two, like economic reasons, just being able to really build up the platform I needed to be able to live there and kind of survive. And that's important too, right? You can't just.
Yes.
So when I was ready, she had introduced me to a family that Lila at the time was living in the Swedish portion of Sápmi, which is the Sami, you know, Sami territory. And she introduced me to a family that was living in Norway, in Gotageno, in northern Norway. And she took me there, and it was really clear after like the first trip that they were, I don't want to say needed, but were open to having somebody come as a housekeeper, because in the Sami culture, and this is getting to your language, by the way, your language question, but it's important to set the tone of how the language comes into play, right? Mm-hmm. So the Sami in their culture, in the reindeer herding culture, have a sort of a role that a woman would take called a biga. And a biga mm-hmm. would be maybe similar to what the French would call an au pair or something like this. So it would traditionally be a female that would maybe come from another reindeer herding family that maybe didn't have as many reindeer, and so would you know, kind of need to find a job outside of their sita or their group, and they would help another family. And basically, maybe traditionally the role would be like take care of the children, cook the food, slaughter the reindeer, sew the clothes, prepare the lavo, all of these things. So, you know, this isn't a thing today, right? I mean, they don't take on the same roles, but bigas are thought of, and beavers are called that way. So it wasn't, so for them, this idea of having a woman from the outside come in and live with them and maybe help, they had 5 children, and they actually had some grandchildren. Some of the children are grown or close, you know, a little bit younger than me. So they were really open to that. And that was the family that I would ultimately live with for the duration of my time. And in that household, they spoke North Sami language, mm-hmm. and made it really apparent that, you know, one of the things for them is that to understand us, like we don't tell our stories in Norwegian, we don't tell our stories in English, we tell our stories in Sami, mm-hmm. and because our language has a way to so kind of intimately describe the way that we think, the way that we feel, the way that we relate to the tundra or the deuter. And I think they said that, like, to intimately describe the way we relate to the tundra. And so they would always speak to me in Sami. Always. I'd start it and obviously, like, I'd have to get some help translating in the beginning. And then in this village of Kautokeino, there is a school called Sami Ala Skuvla or Sami University. And they had an immersion program in Sami language. And typically it was for Sami people that, you know, like most, the kind of, you know, story all over the world with indigenous culture is colonization and specifically there, the Daru Dufting or the Norwegianization process. So they were sent, you know, Sami were sent to boarding schools and Sami language was illegal until the 1980s. And so obviously there was this huge decline in Sami speakers as a first language. So the school, the Sami University, put this program together for Sami people that had lost their language and as a way to come back and sort of reinvigorate and reaccess, you know, their own language. And what's interesting about the program is that also the sort of philosophy is that it's taught through a Sami perspective. And so that we, again, kind of very similar to what Lila had showed me those first 2 weeks in Sweden, is that you're going to learn Sami language by doing and by immersion. You don't learn it through, you're not going to get a grammar book first. We're not going to sit in the classroom and put things on the board and you're going to repeat them. If you're going to learn about if you're going to learn all the words around fire and berry picking, we're going to go out and you're going to camp for a week. You're going to build fires and you're going to berry pick and you're going to do it all in Sami language. And that was the start of in the program. So it was a real immersion program with sort of a Sami philosophy and how it was taught. And I did that from September to June while living in this house, working as a housekeeper. So speaking Sami, hearing Sami and trying to speak, you know, all day long and then being in this a full immersion program. And what I realized is that the process of learning Sami language not only did help me to gain a better understanding of, right, the Sami interpretation and relationship to the Arctic landscape, but more specifically, like, it actually changed my perception of time. Because the Sami have really specific perceptions of time. Like I said, like she mentioned first, I had to live there for a year. So in order to understand the Sami culture, the Sami go through this yearly cycle because it's a year cycle of whatever of the year, but also it's how the reindeer follow the cycles. So they always say that we follow the reindeer and the reindeer follow the yearly cycle. So from that, I realized that my way to perceive time changed based on the Sami. So I can't explain it, but as I began to understand the language, or the language became more intuitive inside of me, like I could perceive an hour as like 15 hours. And that's, and so if you're sitting on the tundra and you're waiting for weather to change, like all of a sudden, and you're in like this, I remember it's really specific. It was called murku or winter fog. Mm-hmm. And you'd sit in this winter fog. So you have no other sort of markers, right? The sun's kind of, everything's just one kind of hazy color. There's no horizon line because that's been obscured by the fog. And you really have nothing else. And time, the sound literally travels in different ways. So you could be sitting there for an hour, but I could be sitting there for 15 hours. And I don't know the difference. And when that begins to happen, right, like story takes on a different form. Time begins to change. You can hear the past, present, and future. But the actual Sami language has ways to, if you want to say like technically or like scientifically, I don't even know the word, to explain this, right? Like it's like how they have something called like you can judge a distance by how far you hear the dog. Mm-hmm. And so this would, you know, all these things would begin to seep in. And so what would happen as I learned the language, I literally began to change my perspective. And so the way that I absorbed story changed too. So I want to be clear. I'm never saying that I'm going to tell a story from a Sami perspective or I am standing at a Sami perspective. But what I'm saying is through this absorption of language and an amount of time spent in a certain landscape, the Sami were able to use that setting to show me the story they wanted to tell me. And therefore, like, where I, even positions, physical positions of where I would photograph would change, because they would say, well, before, when I would first get there, I'd want to be really close up to a reindeer or something, because I thought being close up meant that I could feel it more. But the Sami would have this, especially the Sami herder, they'd always want to be really far away and see it from a distance so they could get a sense of the entire landscape, what's going on with the weather, like how many reindeer, what the food looks like for the reindeer based on the landscape. So you'd begin to hear this, at first I'd begin to see it in Sami artwork in general, I'd begin to hear it in Sami storytelling, and then through the Sami language itself, this actual, like, positioning of where people would stand and would come out in the words they'd use to describe. And so all of this influenced the way that I understood the story they were telling me, and therefore the way that I'm translating the story. Because ultimately what was happening is I'm a translator of the story that the Sami allowed me to see and understand. And even as by learning Sami language, I'm still interpreting it, you know, through my lens of how I understood the language.
You mentioned that the Sami followed the herds, of course, the reindeers, and the reindeers follow the seasons. So that is basically the cycle of the year. Would you talk about that a little bit more? To what extent is the original culture of following the herds and of nomadism still being practiced?
Yeah, so, I mean, again, that's an interesting question. I don't know. I mean, right, I really believe this, and it's like a good way to set it out. Like, we are change, right? That's mm-hmm. that's all we are. Yeah. So, I mean, to say originally, what does that mean? Because we're always changing, right? So, yeah. I mean, I think if you kind of maybe, if you want to put it into some sort of blocks, right? Sami were reindeer hunters first, then they became reindeer herders. And, you know, that's already one process, rather you just following the reindeer to hunt them, and then they began to. So actually the word for Sami reindeer herders is boatsuvatsi, which means reindeer walkers. So they actually don't call themselves herders, they call themselves reindeer walkers. And because, you know, when they stopped, you know, just hunting reindeer, they began to walk with the reindeer as they began to be kind of more, you know, domesticating them. And so I would say that typically what I would hear, something of the past coming into the present, if you want to kind of think about it in that regard, is that the Sami would always follow the reindeers. They would walk behind them or ski behind them. They would follow them as opposed to necessarily herding them. But what I'd say that you'd see today is maybe a mix of that. There's still this idea that you follow the reindeers, but I think there also can be quite herded. And that's, that's based on several things. It's based on economic pressures. It's based on land-based pressures, you know, as you went from, you know, as cultures became, you know, less nomadic and more living in villages and cities. And then as you start to deal with governments and then all these regulatory systems that begin to, you know, over the past hundreds and hundreds of years infringe on sort of our hunter-gatherer nomadic way of being, you know, the culture has really acclimated to that. And then the ultimate thing would be, is like I said, they regulate under the European Union, so they have to take, you know, the same sort of specifications for slaughtering that happen in the south of Spain have to happen in on the tundra in the north of Norway. So, you know, maybe they're more actually herders today, where they have to move them, and other things have happened with land right uses, right? Maybe back in the day, a family would have had one, you know, follow the reindeer to one specific area based on the reindeer, right? In the summer, just to give an example, they want to go to colder weathers higher up to get away from mosquitoes and keep it, you know, not get mosquitoes and also look for better grazing grass. Mm-hmm. That would be a reason that they would move to a specific area naturally. But let's say now, the Sami don't have the rights to that area because there's a community there or a summer resort or whatever reason, it's a national park, who knows, whatever the reason is, that they don't have access to that. So they would literally have to herd them to a specific area that they do have the grazing rights to that perhaps mimics that landscape. And then that's been a process too. Maybe that area changed 30 years ago. So the new generation look at that as the normal thing, but 30 years ago, that wasn't where they would have been. So again, this process of change and evolution and evolution and acclimation is really relative to where you're standing. But does that answer the question?
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. It makes it very clear that you're not able and shouldn't compare two static points of time, artificial points of times, but it is a transition, and it has been for a long time, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I would say that one of the things that I've heard from the Sami, and I actually, this is, tends to happen with people that I've spent time with that have really close ties in their daily life to the natural world, right? Meaning with their subsistence to some degree and things like that. You know, they would say that, you know, the most important thing we are is our adaptability to change. Because people always ask me that about climate change, like how are these cultures dealing? And I think most people always say to me, if you really ask them that really blunt, like straightforward question, how are you dealing with climate change? They would say that, you know, we've been dealing with that since time immemorial as well. Like we are constantly changing and adapting and learning new ways to interact with our landscape. And again, a constant reminder for them that they are a part of the landscape. I would say that, you know, I'm not saying that they're sitting in front of the mirror saying, I'm reminding myself I'm a part of the landscape. But I would say that there is that, there is some level of awareness that by when you're working so closely that you are constantly reminding yourself that you are a working part of this landscape. So you have to adapt and learn new tools to interpret what's around you and to kind of manage in practical ways. And that brings me, sorry, to one more thing about manage, which is really beautiful.
Yes, sure, please.
So in the Sami language, the Sami have this word called, oh, sorry, but it's been a long time since I've been there, so I'm butchering Sami language at this point, but beregit, which is like to manage. That's what it means. And it's really interesting, but I learned, or at least I interpreted that I learned, you know, the word to manage for Sami people doesn't mean that you like manage the money in your bank account or manage your household. It's like it's like it comes from their way of being able to survive on their landscape. And of course, the word, they might say that in the household, not like, oh, I'm managing something, but it comes from this idea of that, you know, as we are working parts of nature, we learn to manage ourselves as a way of survival. And so this word has kind of now translated, if you want to say like someone sitting there doing their checkbook in their, mm-hmm. in their house, but it comes from this idea of being a working part of nature.
And being a working part of nature also makes it possible to use nature in all kinds of ways, for example, for medicine, if you are sick, right? And I believe that traditional medicine in the Arctic was one of the subjects that you were particularly interested in.
Yes, I mean, I think one of my main questions going there was, like I said, was what makes us uniquely human in the cycles of life and death? And that is like separating, right? And that's my own kind of bias coming in, separating humans from other things. And again, I wasn't really trying, that's not really the point of what I'm trying to do. But I do think that it was important to, for some reason, for me to understand, you know, uniquely as a human, what are we learning through the cycles of life and death? And part of that became another like kind of sub question of, why do we want to heal in any ways? You know, why is that? What is our, you know, what is the drive in us to want to heal? And again, it could be as simple as, you know, nature wants to continue and heal. I get that, that there's, you know, kind of the impetus of nature in general. But I had it more, I don't know, because whenever we're thinking, we overthink things in life. I thought, you know, why do we even want to heal? What is that? What is that in us that wants to repair? So my question going to the Sami wasn't so much about like, how do you use the herbs to heal? Mm-hmm. But, you know, what is it in the culture that, you know, what is your relationship to healing? And what has the Arctic created in you to help interpret its ability and your function to act that out? So that was one. Yeah. And so I saw that in many different ways, right? You see it in a way of being. You see it through the language itself, through the stories that the culture holds and through obviously knowledge of the landscape from places that have been important ancestrally and today. And then things like knowing, you know, very basically how to get vitamin C in the winter, you know, and survive.
In your talk on National Geographic Live, it's been quite a few years ago. Maybe you still remember it. You talked about the reindeer bubble. Do you remember what exactly mm-hmm. you meant with that expression? I mean, I know the liberal bubble on the East Coast and the US or whatever, but what is a reindeer bubble?
Yeah, so it was something that literally was built around me or that I entered without knowing.
Yeah.
And I didn't have... It's like you don't know it until you're not in it anymore. So, right, there's certain, I think that's, we could experience that as humans in general. You don't realize sometimes what you're experiencing until you're not experiencing it anymore. And I just specifically, I was there for, I don't know how long without leaving, but like maybe 8 months or something. Mm-hmm. And it was in the time that I had been, really heavily learning Sami language. So my mind was also quite, all my senses were tuned into to all things Sami. And then I got a job to go photograph like some Norwegian companies and their relationships to natural resources, but outside of Gotageno in the south, more southern Norway. And so I took the job because I needed it, and I went, and all of a sudden I flew off. I remember just getting kind of off of the airplane in, I think I was in Bodø or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I realized not everybody speaks Sami. In fact, nobody's speaking Sami. And all of a sudden, like, I was like, oh, I've got to meet somebody at a very specific time on my watch. All of a sudden, my conversations, things weren't just understood that they would be Sami. There was questions of, well, why are you learning Sami? Or what are you doing there? All of a sudden, it's, I was no longer just being anymore. I almost realized it. I was like, oh my gosh, I felt more foreign outside of the Sami culture than I did being there.
Which could be considered a great success in terms of what you tried to achieve, right? By immersing yourself into that culture.
Yeah, but I wouldn't say I was trying that. I would say that it was what happened. Mm-hmm. And that was, I never tried or thought that's the way it was going. It was, like I said, I really go back to believing the story will teach you in the manner that you're meant to be taught, in the manner mm-hmm. that you need to learn. And that's what that was what the story sort of did and took me in that regard. But yeah, I didn't realize until I wasn't there that this was not going on everywhere in the world. All of a sudden, I realized that I was not in this reindeer bubble. And specifically, like, I realized, oh my goodness. So at the very beginning, not that first 2 weeks of Lila, but like a month or so after, I remember I was out, like, looking at the reindeer, and some people came up to me, some Sami herders, and they're like, you know what? There was a little bit of opposition in the beginning about me being there with a camera, and understandably so. And I remember them saying, like, oh, you photographers, all you want to do is show us as lavos and sunsets and reindeer. And that's, you know, like, and I remember, then I listened to that, and of course I was absolutely, you know, also I was like sensitive to that, you know, I get what they're saying. They want, they're telling me in this very short minute that they're more than lavos and sunsets and reindeers.
Yes.
And that's important. But what I realized when I had gotten out of my reindeer bubble, I was like, oh my gosh, how much lavos and sunsets and reindeers were literally like infused into everything. And I'm really not being flippant in saying that that's all Sami people are. But what I mean is that those symbols, and that's why actually symbols and patterns are really important to me. It's why I had asked about the patterns behind you. But those symbols that somehow physically manifest onto cultures sometimes are not, again, they, it's important how they're interpreted by people themselves and then outside people, but also sometimes they're there for a reason as well. And I think that, you know, at the core, I realized at least the family that I was living with, I mean, the reindeer were the core of everything, and they actually did guide the yearly cycle. It guided the daily cycle. It guided the cultural, the spiritual, the historical. It guided everything. Everything we did revolved around reindeer.
So all of that, as we have already mentioned, is quite a few years ago now that it happened. I think you have been with the Sami from 2007 to 2011. If you think back to this time from today's perspective, are you able to pinpoint which impressions, what learnings, which kind of insights from this time stuck with you the most and maybe still influence you today, the way you think about certain things?
Yes, I really can. It's actually more so now than before, which is really funny. Like, mm-hmm. that's what, I mean, I actually think all this talk about time, you know, I think the Sami taught me to see time in a new way. And I think the further I get from the time that I spent with them, the more acute that becomes, which is really mm-hmm. interesting. Like this, so that just this breaking of, you know, my conception of time to see in new ways. I would say that one of the things that I realized with the Sami, and probably again with a little bit with the, my interest in the way that I was going there to experience the story, I also saw it as like, and I relate this to storytelling as well, right? If you think about a lot of what people would call these original storytellers, like they were somewhat shamanistic mm-hmm. in their beliefs as well. And the shamans themselves would have these like, how should I say, they would have these ways of experiencing deaths to become new again. And I look at that really, actually, I look at that at life in general. Like we are constantly kind of shedding old skin and putting new skin on as we learn new things and new ways to act in the world and like kind of synergize ourselves with the world. So I would say that my time with the Sami again really taught me that there was this kind of sort of small death of my identity as I had built it. And they gave me the gift of new information to kind of put on new clothes, if you want to say. And those new clothes would then eventually, right, like your skin gets tougher and tougher and then you go out into the world and you grow up. And so I still think that that sort of rebuild of myself exists in now in who I am. And I would say that it definitely, it influences the way that I saw myself as a storyteller. So then the way that I engaged in storytelling after that, obviously, you know, I was like lucky to kind of take on a new language, which breaks all different perceptions of how you interpret things around you. And I, you know, still have, you know, all of that. You can't go back to the way it was before once you see things that way. I would say that probably the most personally, if those things aren't personal enough, but mm-hmm. The Sami really showed me a way to think about family and what that means in our human journey. And I never, so I would say after being with the Sami, I felt that I wanted to become a mother. And so that was something that, you know, really changed for me as well. I didn't have that before. And now I actually am planning on going back. I'm not sure if it'll 100% happen, but I'm planning on going back to Norway for a couple of years next year. Because I think it's time to kind of go through another cycle.
So you would spend more time with the Sami as well, if that happens?
Yes, some for sure. Not the entire time. Yeah. I've got some other things that... So my family, I told you, is from Norway as well.
Yes.
So I have, you know, my own ties to Norway in different ways. But yeah, absolutely. And so I've talked with the family that I lived with and she always said, she's like, okay, it's been 10 years. It's time to like, come back.
The big reunion.
I've been back over the 10 years, of course, mm-hmm. but like to really, you know, maybe think about the visual interpretation again. So we'll see. We'll see how it is. But the reason I say that is that's not everything that I do that I want to go back 10 years later. I want to, you know, I think there's something very specific about spending time. And this is, again, this is a question and I don't have the answer to it and I don't think I ever will. But I'm really, one of my main questions always is constantly driving me is does landscape itself like predicate what you feel, what you think, how you act, what you do, you know, the landscape. I mean, why is the rainforest different than the Arctic besides the obvious reasons? For me, it's clear that the landscape itself really dramatically drives the makeup of how we physically manifest, you know, who we are. And so I think going back to Sápmi for some reason is really important for that. for a kind of reboot and seeing and hearing again in new ways.
Well, and I would say that you helped us seeing and hearing in new ways through this conversation. It was a really fascinating journey for me, and I would like to thank you a lot for taking the time to telling us about your experiences with Asami, Erica. Thank you so much for that.
Thank you.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.